my era was more work than it was brains. I mean, it's okay to be smart, but you just can't beat, you know, somebody that's outworking you.
So, I mean, you've done a lot of your own podcasts, and hopefully I can send some of the listeners over to your stuff for some more in-depth, you know, season by season stuff. Tell me a little bit about that program, your podcast, and all your archive stuff that you've been doing lately.
The coolest thing that we got going on with my son, Matt, is has started markmartinarchive.com and doing a lot of historical diecast and retro historical t-shirts and all that stuff. So go check out markmartinarchive.com. He also has an Instagram page, which is incredible, Mark Martin Archive on Instagram, if you're on Instagram as well. Really, some really cool old stuff. All of this is kind of leading up to a book that will be coming out in the next couple of years. We're already a year into it and only have one chapter composed so far. So a lot of information. But anyway, that's kind of what we got going on our side. But I'm looking forward to talking with you today about Gene Hanley.
Yeah, hopefully a little bit, just trying to get that angle. He's, I don't know, half an hour from my place. And so my crew chief, and I don't know if you'll remember or not from the time you spent at Junior's shop, my crew chief is Little John, John Fletcher's son.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Yeah, so John works here full-time, and his little brother, Scott, both work here on our Canadian NASCAR program.
Awesome. That's cool.
So lots of good stories always from them.
Yeah.
But let's, you know, you have done so much, but maybe my audience won't have done such a deep dive, so I really want to have this kind of be a little bit of a standalone podcast. So let's go back to, I guess, growing up. Tell us where you grew up and how you got into motorsports, because everyone has a little bit of a different story how they got introduced.
Well, first of all, the other part of it is, if any of your listeners want to find out about any particular year of my career, I've got a year by year from day one, 1974, all the way through the end of my career on markmartinpod.com. So you can check it out there. But I don't know, my dad was, and I were both race fans when we were young and coming up, and you know, we went to the races, and we went to the Daytona 500 and sat in the stands in the early 70s. And in 1973, we were at the local dirt track, and it was the last night of the season. And I was 14, and I said, let's build me one of these things for next year.
And he was good with it? It didn't take any convincing?
No. My dad was, there'll be a lot about that in the book. My dad was one of a kind character. And so we drug a 55 Chevy into the shop and started gutting it and making a race car out of it. Started on the dirt tracks in Arkansas. Worked my way up, the ranks through there. Through Arkansas, and then in 1977, I decided to build to go to pavement because the Daytona 500 wasn't on dirt.
Right.
So we built an asphalt car, got a Howe chassis, put it all together, and all that is a really important year in 77. And I go into great detail about that in the 1977 episode there on markmartinpod.com. But I really want, you know, I want to talk about Junior Hanley because he's a freaking hero, a freaking legend. He made me better. And in 1977, when I started asphalt racing, my first recollection of Junior is we pulled into Owosso, Michigan in 1977, and we're running Firestone tires, and Junior drags his car in next to me, his little truck and open trailer. And his car's probably, my car's fairly raggedy from race wear, and his car was more raggedy. It's kind of a rough looking piece. He backed her off the trailer and we had practice. He was on, he had four brand new Goodyears on, 15 39s on the right, a 1541 on the left rear, and whatever the compound for the S, I believe it was S39, a super soft left front tire, super soft. S19 was the compound on it. I don't remember what the serial number was, but anyway, I remember that from 1977. And he comes over to our trailer. He says, "You got any cardboard?" We start looking around, scrounging around, trying to help this racer, you know. Gave him a piece of cardboard and he kind of cut it a little bit and he taped it over the radiator grill. It's right before qualifying. Before I don't know, before I get it, okay? I don't get it. He goes out and sets fast time and he comes back in, pulls back in. That thing's overheated. It's just like making a loud noise. It's so hot. It's sitting there just, and I'm like, we're thinking like, this guy's a freaking lunatic. I mean, who does that? And I mean, that thing was just making a loud noise over there, steam and all that, you know. And anyway, he whoops us. So he goes out there and he wins the race. It was ASA race, and he wins. Seneca, Bob Seneca runs second. I ran third. Had a great race with Bob. But that's my first recollection of Junior. And our careers, late model careers, kind of parallel each other. You know, my 78 car was nicer. His 78 car was nicer. But 79, he's really starting to build some lightweight cars and getting heavy lift and stuff and drilling holes in the frame rails and like. I got to go. I mean, I got to spend 18 hours a day, 7 days in a week. I have got, my stuff's got to be, you know, I got to, you know, try to one up Junior Hanley. And so in that way, Junior made me a better racer, because there was no one in late model racing that was as aggressive as he was, other than Gary Ballou. And Gary was way down in Florida. Of course, I was still in Arkansas or just getting up into Indiana, but I still raced against Junior quite often, Indiana, Michigan, and whatnot. So, Junior and Gary Ballou made me, you know, they've challenged me, forced me to go to the extremes, you know, and Junior's just an amazing guy. In 1984, I needed a race car, and Ray Dillon told me that the days of free cars were over after helping him design the Dillon chassis and you know, owning the world in 80, 81, 82. Tells me going into 84 season that those days were over with. So I bought a car from Junior.
Because
And
he wasn't giving anything away free.
no. So I bought a, if I was going to buy a car, I'm going to buy a Hanley car. So as all these things always work out, I went to his shop. It was supposed to be turnkey. Me and my one employee turnkeyed it. You know, it did have the body on it, but I don't think it was wired and it certainly wasn't plumbed. And we worked on it until we got it scaled out and ready to go to the racetrack. We left right from there and went straight to the racetrack with it. So That's my one and only experience. It was several days there at your shop in 1984. And that's really my only experience there. But Junior Hanley is, I don't know. He's a racing god in my eyes.
For sure. That must have been such a stroke of luck for you to, so early in your career to start running against those guys and just, like them being the sandpaper that makes the whatever the fine art, helping push you to just say, hey, this is what it takes. And within such a short amount of time, from you starting to you now building some of the baddest cars.
It was quite an evolution from 1977 to 1981, which my finest cars, were 1981 because I got better every year, and we got better every year and whatnot. And then in 82, I went NASCAR racing, so I didn't build my own cars anymore. So that kind of all changed. But those years, 77, 78, 79, they really were, that was the foundation that that I built my career on. And learned, I really learned a lot about cars, the most probably ever about race cars, aerodynamics and chassis and weight distribution and all those things.
Now, from for the time, you started at such a young age compared to a lot of other guys starting back then, not by today's standards. But when did everything fall on you as far as building a car as opposed to your dad helping out? Was that pretty much right away?
No, in 79, in 77 was my first year on asphalt. I actually accidentally won ASA Rookie of the Year. Then in 70, and they gave me Hal. I was running the Hal car. They gave me a free chassis for 78 after winning Rookie of the Year. Built a new, nicer car for 78, and I won the ASA Championship in 78. And then in 79, I was getting antsy. It was a long way to race out of Batesville, Arkansas, and I was kind of under my dad's thumb, to some degree, and I was feeling like a man. So I loaded up, and it was about March. I loaded up, our new car for 79 and the truck and trailer, and headed to Dillon's and raced out of North Liberty, Indiana. And so I was independent starting in 79, but I ran a Hal car out of Dillon's property. And about halfway through that year, he approached me about designing the Dillon chassis. And so we designed it and debuted it. The Snowball Derby in November or in December, of 79. And so 70, I'm sorry, debuted, yeah, no, December 79. So 1980 was my, really first, I was independent of my dad. He still helped. He would still buy me some tires now and then. He'd still come to the races. He'd be my gas man. He still helped as he could, but I was running my program as a standalone business without a sponsor, but I didn't, I didn't have to buy anything. I got you back then, product wise, you could get, as ASA champion, you could get free everything.
Can you explain to, guys my age and people who haven't been around and looked at the history, just how big the ASA deal was and how important it was to win that championship for you, or three in a row?
Because it was covered in Stock Car Magazine and covered in Speed Sport News, and that was like the internet of the day. That was everything. I was, shoot, man, I was in Stock Car Magazine almost every month, and it was most greatly due to ASA. It was a national touring organization. It had great PR, great media coverage. They taught me how to do interviews. They took me under their wing as a kid and taught me how to prepare me for NASCAR, really. They taught me how to do all the things and gave me all the tools that I was going to need later in my career. And I was able to hone and develop those while I was racing in ASA. There's nothing really like that now. And so it really, the state of pavement racing is much weaker now than it was at that time. And there were a lot of great specials, Art Go series in Wisconsin, and a lot of great racing in Wisconsin. But the thing that got you national attention was that ASA series. So I won the championship 78, 79, and 80, 3 years in a row before I prepared to go NASCAR racing.
Now, how did you, say starting in 77 or 78, how did you conceptualize your career and your business? Was it always you're going cup racing is the goal? And were you looking at guys like Junior who were making a living racing late models and saying, hey, this might be a path too? Or was it, no, I want to go cup racing?
I want to go cup racing from back in the dirt track, days. Okay. I wanted to be a NASCAR driver. Only as it started to look realistic after we started winning dirt track races and then going to Daytona and to the races and seeing those races and seeing the worldwide of sports clips on television of NASCAR races and stuff. So I wanted to, that was my goal. I wanted, my goal really was a stupid goal, but I wanted to win the Daytona 500 by the time I was 25, which there weren't hardly any 25-year-olds that even drove NASCAR cars, But yeah. I did 5 cup races in 81, and in the third one I sat on the pole. And in the fourth one I sat on the pole and finished 7th. And the fifth one I ran third with my ASA pit crew and everything. We'd never been to NASCAR races before in 1981, except in the stands.
Yeah. Can you explain, to people who don't know, how you went about cup racing, like on your own, with your guys, and you brought a hot rod of a cup car that first year? Can you kind of explain how that car was probably in a different league than a lot of the other guys?
So I took my front snout, Dylan, a stock stub Camaro front snout with, the upper A-frames like we run and everything. So I knew what geometry I was going to be running on the car. I took it down south, had Will Cronkite build the frame cage and hang the body because we didn't know how to do that to the rules of NASCAR. Mm. And then I finished it out and built the car, used the same radiator. They run big, heavy, fat radiators, giant oil coolers and all that stuff. I just ran my ASA car parts. They say little bitty lightweight radiator, little bitty lightweight oil cooler, 2 gauges, no tack, just this normal psycho stuff.
Yeah.
And my cup car had 60, most of those cup cars had 53% left side weight if they were a good car. My cup car had 60% left side weight, had 600 pounds of lead. It was nuts. It was before its time. It was just a short track car, just around the half miles. But I built it just as close to my late model as I could on everything that I could, parts wise and knowledge wise. And we just went and did it. We just went and did it. You can't do that now.
No,
it'd be, you can't do it.
Why were the Cup guys, why did they lack that mentality that you had and Junior had and Gary had? Why did they lack the, I don't know, the imagination or the work ethic or whatever it was?
What I think, and I'm dumb, but this is what I think. So they started racing passenger cars in NASCAR. They right. drove their car to the, you know, in the 50s or whatever. They drove their car to the race. They race it. They drove it home. Their race cars evolved from passenger cars. When I got into late model racing, they were purpose-built race cars. They were never passenger cars. I mean, my first HAL car did have a Camaro front snout on it, stock snout on it, stock steering, but the rest of it was all built, hand-built to be a race car. And so, you know, those cars were purpose-built, our late models. And I think that the NASCAR car just evolved over time. You know, they became purpose-built cars, you know, by the, you know, sometime in the late 80s maybe, but they were still evolving in the early 80s from, you know, more, you know, archaic type technology. And they understood and were more about racing 500 miles. And I didn't. You know, we understood racing, you know, 100 lappers, and a 500 lapper was a long race for us. A 400 lapper was a long race for us. We'd do that a couple times a year, and that was it. So there was just a lot of difference in mentality.
For sure. So you show up and, you know, you're fast. You put it on the pole a couple times, and you're running good on the short tracks. And then you say, is it the next season that you say, okay, we're going to go do this full time? And it didn't work out. What kind of went on there? What were you lacking, I guess, in knowledge, or what was it?
So I didn't know what I was getting into. In 81, I did 5 races in between all my late model races and 5 Busch Xfinity, you know, Xfinity races on super speedways to get a, you know, a little bit of super speedway experience. I did the 5 short tracks with the Cup car. I had no idea what I was getting into, but after running 3rd, you know, sitting on 2 poles and running 7th and 3rd, I felt like I'd win a race in the first 5 or 10 races of the 1982 season. And I thought everything would work out from there. If I won a race, sponsorship would come, and I just thought everything would work out. And I was wrong. I was going up against, you know, Junior Johnsons and people who understood. I didn't understand how hard it was to race every weekend with a Cup car versus racing every weekend with your late model. And I just didn't have, I ran out of money after the first race, and the performance wasn't there from the, you know, that we had the year before. And we just fell on our face. And by the end of the year, I was in debt up to my ears and a failure. And I had to auction and sold all everything I owned, including the toolbox, and planned on never, you know, owning a team again and just being driving for somebody. And I got a ride, but it lasted 7 races and I got fired after 7 races. And after I got fired, they were done with me in NASCAR. So that's when I went back to Dillon to start my career all over again from scratch without a toolbox. And that was hard. And my dad fronted me the money to buy the Hanley car. And I did manage to squeak out 1 win, ASA win with that Hanley car in 84. And then I got on my feet in 85 and 86. 86, I won the ASA championship again and was able to, you know, I had rebuilt my career, but I had fallen all the way to the bottom.
Now, how long did you kind of sit down in the dumps mentally before you know, you have this goal, this burning desire to be a Cup driver. Did you give up on that for a little bit, or how did you conceptualize that part of your career?
Yeah, I gave up. I was bitter and had a chip on my shoulder toward NASCAR and didn't plan on ever, you know, racing NASCAR again. I planned on making a living short track racing, racing my late model on pavement. And I went to work and supported my family, and we eventually got where we could win some races, and then we won a championship. And then that took 3 years. And, you know, by the time we won the championship, I was starting to get opportunities to go back down south that were going to be more lucrative than what I was, you know, than ASA racing was. And I needed to do that for my family. I was making money, but it would have been really good money for a bachelor. But, you know, I had a wife and four little girls. I needed more. And so I went back NASCAR racing and kind of stair-stepped back into a situation where I could finally race to win.
Right. Now, you've told this story, I think, probably on Junior's podcast, when you were running your own Cup program. You know, you're in your little shop there with no insulation and no heat, and you got a call to drive the 28 car. For guys who don't know, can you just explain how significant that deal would have been?
In 81, after the last race that I ran, and we ran third at Martinsville, I'm back in the pole barn in North Liberty, Indiana, working on a race car in my shop, and the slimline phone that hangs on one of the poles rings, and I answer it, and he says, "Mark, this is Waddell Wilson." "Hey, Waddell." He says, "I'd like to know if you'd be interested in driving the 28 car." That's the 28 car that sat on the pole for the Daytona 500 in February. This was like November. That was the car that won the Daytona 500 in 83. I mean, how many Daytona 500s is a 28 car run, and how many poles and all that stuff? So I didn't even hesitate. I said, "No, Waddell, rather do my own deal." I didn't, you know, the horror stories were you wouldn't let the drivers in the shop. They wouldn't let the drivers work on the car. I damn sure knew more about the cars than they did at the time. I already showed them up in my very third race. You know, I didn't know anything about running 500 milers, but I thought it was all the same as, you know, running the 400 lapper at Nashville, and it wasn't. But anyway, I thought I knew more. Number one, I had employees that am I going to say, "Hey, I know we're going NASCAR racing, but you're fired." I was going to go to Dylan, who helped me in every way, and go to Ray and say, "I know, it's been nice. See ya." I mean, I just didn't feel comfortable. I just felt like everything said I needed to do my own deal. I felt like I'd have better race cars. I'd be loyal to the people that got me there. My engines, Ron Neal prototype, all that stuff. And so I was like, "No, Waddell, I'd rather do my own deal." Benny Parsons wound up getting the ride. He lasted to Talladega and got fired. It's hard for me to imagine that I would have drove better than Benny. There's a 50-50 chance that I'd have gone down there and done great, won and drove that car and won the Daytona 500 by the time I was 25. And then there's another chance that would say I got fired and I lost my entire career, which I did anyway. It was a no-brainer at the time, but I look back on it and I'm glad that I said no. I'm glad that I failed. I'm glad that it nearly ruined my life, because it made me a better person. And it made me, you know, in the end, the struggle made me, you know, a different racer.
Right. Now, I think that's something a lot of racers can relate to. You know, there's lots of stops and starts in careers and, you know, running out of money and lack of sponsorship nowadays. But when you went broke, and I mean, there's stories out there that you sold everything at auction and you paid everyone that you owed. And a lot of guys, you know, their true colors show when they're out of money and they've got the opportunity to say, hey, I've got no money, I'm not paying you. Where did that strength of character come from for you, and just the drive? I've heard you say it before, the drive to be, you know, a stand-up guy and someone with integrity. Where did that come from?
Came from my parents. I mean, that was just in me. It was like, I remember as a kid asking my dad, why are you doing that? Because whatever it was he was doing at the time was not good for him. And he said, because I gave my word. And so it didn't matter. He gave his word, so no matter how not good it was for him, he did it. He had to do it. He did it. And so, you know, your word just was so important. And just, I learned respect, and the respect I learned and gained and earned, the appreciation for that. It was something that I think that you earn over time and learn over time. And it all started with my parents.
For sure. You know, and I think it really isn't, I think it is a selfish in the long run, because it, you know, it makes you a reliable person, and it, you know, people want to do whatever business with you, hire you as a race car driver, et cetera, et cetera, in the long run. What did you learn from that, like going broke? What did you learn about your business side of things, and how you went back? How did you approach, you know, going back to Cup differently the next time around?
I was a lot more careful, and a lot less confident in myself. And if you notice, I stayed with Jack Roush, gave me a chance when no one else would. And I stayed with him for 19 years. And that was one of the big reasons, was loyalty to someone who gave me a chance when nobody else would. But it was a character builder for sure to go through all that and come out the other side. And it was a work in progress. You know, I wasn't changed overnight.
Right. Now you jump forward to when you're racing for Jack Roush. You've got a good car. You guys are winning races. And I've heard you say that chasing that Cup championship for almost a decade almost ruined your life, or made you miserable. How so? And what's the difference in that mentality as opposed to race by race?
So it robbed me of my joy. It robbed me of a large portion of the joy of the experience and of the life. That's because, you know, you're always preoccupied with improving your performance, but that wasn't enough. It was so gutting when you would have a flat tire or a broken part, or the caution came out right after you pitted under the green. All these things, a lot of these things you couldn't control. And I never had I had enough performance to win championships, but I never had enough performance to overcome the mess of things that happened every year. So I had a lot of great runs for periods of time, but I never, for one full points counting season, you know, I never had enough performance to overcome the seemingly more than average problems that I would encounter. So it robbed me of you know, my joy, and I hate that. I hate that I let that happen.
Right. Running for a championship compared to individual races, you start to see each race really as a means to an end, as opposed to if you're going out there just looking for wins. You know, each race you can focus on, and it's an end in itself. And yeah, if you have a flat tire, then you just go home, and that's the way it went. But you know, you're so, it removes your mind, I guess, so much from the moment to the end of the season.
Yeah, it was all about that points tally after the last race. The whole season was. So you'd be sick at your stomach at the third race of the season when something would go wrong. Or there'd be a wreck in front of you and you'd be in it. You'd already start agonizing over, you know, and it's like if you were just running that race, it would be a short-lived agonized feeling. But, you know, it was a season-long anticipation and worry and frustration because you couldn't, of the things that you couldn't control, that were out of your own control, and just a lot of things like that.
Right. Now, I heard that you kind of got robbed of a championship or lost a championship because of a tech dispute near the end of the season.
What was that? It was the second race of the season. Yeah.
Oh, was it? Okay.
So we were at Richmond in 1990, and when they got ready to leave the shop, they put, I think there was a rule, inch and a half carburetor spacer max. And for nearly a year, the NASCAR had been allowing you to weld to the intake manifold to raise it up as much as you wanted because one manufacturer had a big advantage. And so then they let the others, rather than recast manifolds, add to the manifolds. Well, they put an inch and a half spacer on it, closed the hood, and the air cleaner was a half inch away from the hood. So they just opened it up and put a 2-inch spacer on it. But right. Technically, it rode red, inch and a half carburetor spacer max. And, you know, passed tech all weekend. But after the race, Richard Childress brought an official over there and pointed and said, there it is. And so they came down on us. You know, they penalized us a lap and took 46. We won the race, of course. They took 46 points for us and something like 50 grand. And that's not really what cost us a championship because we took the lead over in June at Sonoma and led the points all season long to the next to last race at Phoenix. And we go out there and we just don't run good. We just bust our butt all day and run 10th. And Earnhardt happens to sit on the pole, lead the most laps, and win the race. And so we went from behind us to launched in front of us. And then we went to Atlanta with just about a need to win. We ran out of gas twice and had an ignition go out and still ran sixth. Dale ran third. You know, I mean, we needed to win.
Right.
And we didn't run good enough to win and didn't have the kind of luck to win. So it is what it is, you know. We wound up losing the championship by 26 points. We'd have won it by 20 points if they would have used reason. You know, it just wasn't, their penalty wasn't real reasonable.
Right. Did that put a sour taste in your mouth a little bit? Like, you know, being exposed to the politics that were in NASCAR, I'm sure they're not as big as they are in F1, but they certainly play a role.
You know, I felt like we'd win one. You know, I mean, I was crushed and disappointed, but it's like our third season together. Our second season together, right. We finished third in the points. Then we finished second the third year. You know, we're going to win championship. And we just had a bunch of near misses. We just wound up running second four more times. And that is what it is. You know, I got beat. I ran second to Dale Earnhardt, Jimmy Johnson, Jeff Gordon, and Tony Stewart.
Right. Right. For sure. For sure. Now, I guess that's not really a big controversy, but were there any big controversies in your career that kind of upset you? You seem like a guy who wants to, you know, do everything the right way. But
I don't remember anything, you know, I don't remember anything. I made mistakes along the way that I hated, you know. I was real hard on myself and didn't accept mistakes very well, but I don't remember any controversies. You know, that was a little controversial, but I don't think NASCAR did that to rob us of a championship. They couldn't know that the second race of the season. I just think that Bill France was the one that made the call. He wasn't at the race, which he usually was. Number one, if he read the rule book, he would say they cheated. If he Right. would have talked with the inspectors, they maybe could have shown him, well, this is what we've been doing and allowing. And I don't think that was really done. So.
Right. Now, maybe you have to go back for this question, go back to some late model days. But I'm going to steal this question. Junior asks, and you're as good a guy to ask as any about some good innovation stories where, you know, maybe you read the rule book and said, hey, they completely missed the boat on this, or, you know, something like that, or lack of technical inspection where you noticed, hey, they're not even looking at this, or just outright getting away with something.
And we did it every week. Junior, myself, Baloo, we caused them to write a new rule every damn week. You know, they'd make a new rule or a template, let's say. Well, we'd fit that template, and 6 inches over from it, we'd go crazy. Because they, you know, then they'd have to make another one. Then they have to make another one. And that's why we are where we are today. It's almost ruined racing. There's so many rules. And it's because of people like Junior and Gary Ballou, the guys that really push. I'm not talking about all of the regular racers that just push the envelope. I'm talking about guys that pushed it hard and fast. And so then you get into NASCAR and it grows so much that there's hundreds of employees at every one of these teams. And them dudes are smart. I mean, I remember when I first went down there were a lot of race teams that didn't have anybody there that I thought was smarter about the race cars than I was. Now, they all are. You know, I mean, it's like, so you have to regulate it. I'm not saying you can turn it back loose. I'm saying you can't put it back in the bottle, though. You can't put the genie back in. And at a big, you know, late model event, it might take a day just to get all the cars through inspection now. And I don't think that's good. You know, I really am a fan of the late model dirt stuff. They show up at 5, get on the racetrack at 6. They get 3 laps of practice. And, you know, by 9 or 9:30, they're getting a green flag for 20, 30, 50,000 to win. Yep. That's how it needs to be. I don't know how asphalt can get to that. I don't know that it ever can. I don't understand why dirt can still do it. Probably won't forever. But right now, they're able to do that. And racing has changed based on technology and smart people. And mean, it can't go back.
No, it definitely can't. And it's changed, I think, the, you know, the driving mentality so much, whereas, you know, all the guys you just mentioned and yourself, you know, you guys are grinding away in the shop, whatever, 18 hours a day to show up with something that's going to turn heads at whatever speed weeks or something. And now that amount of work, if you're really after it as a driver, goes into, you know, looking at brake traces and sitting on the simulator and watching old races. What's your opinion on how much that mentality has changed now for the drivers? They've become so much more, you know, athletes, I guess, or
The thing
students
that I
of
say,
driving.
and it's maybe a stupid analogy, but I say this, when I first started racing, the journalists wrote down on notepads and then they typed their story on a typewriter. That's changed. It will never be the same. It'll never be like that again. The same thing with everything in life has changed and evolved. And so the race today's race car driver, very few grow up in the shop, you know, working on race cars. I didn't spend any time working on my driving craft. I knew that I could beat Junior, or I could beat Blue, or I could beat Dick Trickle, or I could beat Dale Earnhardt if I made my car good enough. And I never thought about, you know, improving my driving. I did what I did and I studied, you know, the track and I did whatever, but, you know, these guys take it to a whole new level. That's all they have to work on. All they have.
Right.
So, you know, the ones with the major work ethic do more than the ones with less. But it is a different game today. And the pathway to the driver's seat is different. And I'm not one of those sour grapes guys that's, you know, said that kid never worked on a race car. Yeah, well, I'd have said that
Right.
in the 80s, you know, but it's not, it's different now. And it's okay if you haven't. Now, I'm your biggest fan. If you've built your own cars and set them up and did your own tires and hung your own bodies, I'm the biggest fan. I'm the, you know, Ryan Preece fan, for example,
Right.
Ty Majewski fan, for example, Chris Buescher, but you know, but William Byron, that's okay with me. He, you know, he got started racing iRacing or whatever, you know. Okay. I'm not gonna hold him down for that. It's a different day and age.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, I guess and correct me if I'm wrong, you probably changed the game a little bit early on, focusing so much on physical fitness. You're an animal in the gym. You're lifting. That's another passion of yours, I guess. How did that come about? Was that out of necessity for fitness in the car, or just
It's
something you
something I
enjoyed?
wanted to do, but I had to work in the shop all the time. So when I finally signed with Jack, finally I didn't have to go to work in the shop. And see, in 1982, when I failed, one of them old guys, not drivers, crew chiefs, said he's too little to drive one of these cars. And that stuck in my craw. And so when I got a chance to drive Jack's car and the six car, and I didn't have to work in the shop anymore, I immediately started, you know, a gym membership and started working on my, what can I do? So I did do that. I didn't study the driving aspect of it, but I put an enormous amount into the physical end of it to be better than everyone else in that way.
Right. Now, being such a little guy, did you ever, you know, it's so easy. I lift weights as well, and it's so easy to kind of get into that gym mentality. Did you ever get sucked into really trying to gain weight and build a bunch of muscle, or was it just to
Into bodybuilding. I mean, that was my thing, and I was obsessed with that, just as I was with racing. But I'm a real, you know, I wasn't able, you know, I built muscle. I was like 6% body fat and, you know, 120 pounds, 120, 125. But getting big just wasn't going to happen for me.
Right. Now, what were you eating or how is that? What were you eating at the time for weightlifting and what are you eating now? I assume you eat pretty clean.
I eat a lot of tuna and sweet potatoes, lots of sweet potatoes, lots of tuna, protein shakes, of course, and all that stuff. I'm on a low-carb thing now where I get a lot of – back then it was low-fat, high carbs and high protein.
Right.
Now I'm high protein, high fat. Low carbs, really try to watch the sugars. That from the latest data that I can wrap my head around, that seems to be the real danger, health danger, is from sugar and refined sugar, but also carbs that you eat that turn into sugar. Aren't great either. So it's not the fat. So that's kind of where I'm at now.
Yeah, no, I'm the same way, and it's just I feel good doing it. You know, I pretty much meat, eggs,
vegetables.
Yeah,
and
I don't go.
That's kind of it.
After used to, I intentionally went after carbs. You know, to go with my fish or whatever, and now I go after vegetables to go with my fish or whatever. And I have no problem with red meat whatsoever. But I still prefer when I have the option, I prefer fish.
Sure. Yeah. That's definitely clean. Right around that time, I guess, and maybe you're starting to lift before then, but you said you started practicing drinking and you got pretty decent at it. What led to giving it up? Was there a kind of a breaking point, or were you one of those guys who, you know, when you drank it changed you a little bit? What was it?
You know, I was an amateur to start with, hanging out with my heroes like Trickle and those guys. So I'd sip beer, but I couldn't drink it. Two, I got where I could drink it. Two, I got into the NASCAR thing and then had the failure. And now I'm getting pretty good at it. And I'm super bitter and angry. And now when I get, you know, drunk, those surface. And they surface in a different way. They don't surface. I'm mad at NASCAR. I'm just an angry person. You see what I'm saying? So that wasn't a very attractive trait, number one. Number two, it continued to be something that I couldn't control. Like, you know, I said, well, I'm not going to get out of control tonight. And I wouldn't. And the next night, I'd say, I'm not going to get out of control tonight, and I wouldn't. And the next night, I'd say that, and I would. And that kind of thing was going to cost me everything in life. It was going to cost me my family. It was going to cost me my career. Therefore, it was going to cost me my life, because that was my life, my family and my career. And so I tried to control it and didn't succeed. And so unfortunately, the way I could control it was to not drink. But if I drank, I didn't ever know for sure when the pin would fall out of the grenade. So I had to quit. And so I did. And I quit first day of 1989. And that's it. And I'm glad that's behind me. My wife still has a glass of wine, or maybe even two once in a while at dinner, whatever. Friends go out to dinner. They may all have a drink. I don't want one. It's been a long time. It's behind me.
Right. Did you need any help with that, or did you just, you're a stubborn guy and you said, I'm done.
You said,
I didn't need any help. Well, I probably needed help, but I did it. I did it on my own.
Right. Right. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, I think there's more and more of a conversation in today's culture, just about how bad alcohol is for you physically, compared to so many drugs even. And, you know, I think in my mind anyway, there's just a lack of a conversation with kids and, you know, guys in their 20s even, about the slippery slope that it is, you know, and that it is a real drug, even though it's available on every corner.
It is a drug. And it's a legal drug, so it's not considered, you know, it doesn't have that stigma. But it is a drug. I have no problem with people having social drinks. Absolutely fine with me, ain't a problem. People that got a problem, they need to quit. Some of the things I learned when I was dealing with my deal was the son of an alcoholic was at the time 6 times more likely to become an alcoholic. 6 times, dude. And my dad was an alcoholic. And I said, I'd never be like that. And one day I was. There's nothing wrong with having drinks. Nothing. But, you know, there are certain people that develop a problem, and those people need to handle their stuff. Is it healthy? Nah, it's not healthy. At all. But dude, we do a lot of stuff that isn't healthy, you know? So I'm not going to run it down the road, but you have a great point. If you really study health and nutrition, you can see the damage that it does. It wreaks havoc on your body, even though you don't realize it. It's not good. It's not good stuff. That alcohol, sugar, turns into, you know, there again, I'm a anti-sugar guy. Yeah, for some people, it's not the right thing. For others, it's great. You know, having social drinks, I don't have any problem with anybody doing that. But some people run into problems with it, and it's ruined a lot of people's lives.
Absolutely. Staying on the health thing for one more minute there. I'm, you know, so into the latest stuff or whatever it is, ice bath, sauna, all that stuff. What else is a part of your regimen there?
Right at the end of my racing career, 13, I was digging the ice bath thing, you know, lifting heavy, deadlifting, squatting, all that stuff. But, you know, I've since had so many injuries that it's time to change your direction in life. So my emphasis is more on functional things. I had a reverse total shoulder replacement on the left last summer, and I'm having rotator cuff repair this summer on the other side. I've battled back problems, battled knee problems. So, I'm doing more rehabish, you know, basic functional stuff rather than the meathead iron lifting stuff like I did for 30 years or whatever it was.
Right, right. Going back to the racing, I guess, as far as injuries, what was your kind of, I guess, biggest crash or worst injuries or any nagging stuff, any concussions early that went undiagnosed, anything like
concussions,
that?
Concussions, I'm sure. Do I know if they are affecting me now? I'm not sure. You know, I don't have, I'm very disappointed in my memory now. I can tell you what springs were in my car and how much tire stagger I had at Owosso that day when I raced with Junior and run third. But I don't know. I can tell you what I had for lunch. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I probably had multiple concussions. I didn't have severe symptoms. You know, never threw up a bunch, never, you know. So I don't know. I had a little right front tire blew out and in 1999 at Daytona, I think it was 99, and in practice, and it broke the tibia plateau and fractured my wrist and cracked a rib. As far as I can remember, that's probably the worst. You know, and it was hard to race, but I raced the next night with all that. I ran 400, the Firecracker 400 the next night. So I don't know. I'm really lucky. I feel like that the things that the chronic pain that I tend to deal with are more from overzealous weightlifting. You know, than racing injuries.
Yeah.
Maybe not, but, you know, and part of it's old age too, but you just, you know, being 120 pounds and deadlifting 225 at 63 years old probably isn't a great idea, especially since I've had fusion, back fusion L5S1. Back in 1999, you know, it's probably not the best idea. It is time for me to, because my weightlifting was unhealthy. I mean, I was, you know, so absurd, you know, consumed with trying to go heavier and heavier and get stronger and get bigger and all that stuff that it wasn't really, you know, I should have. Probably, I'm just that way. Everything I do too much. That's why I had to quit drinking. Now I'm going to have to quit weightlifting, you know. But I'll still resistance train. But it was like quitting drinking for me to change from that to from the heavy iron to something different. It was a mental challenge for me. I just, you know,
for sure.
I've been in my racing career. I was very strong mentally, but everything worked. The racing worked. It was great therapy. Racing the car was great therapy for me, as you know, and you know, it was my escape from any pain that I had or any emotional pain I had or physical pain. And, you know, I live in a different time now and I still get challenged, you know, and I have to face those challenges. Like, dude, what I really wanted 2 years ago was my last day in life. I wanted to go to the gym, lift weights, come home, lay back in the recliner and take my last breath. And now I have to
yeah.
say, I'm not going to do that. So I have to find something else to fixate on because, you know, that might have been 95 years old. You know what I'm saying? So people think,
yep,
I got all kinds of crazy things in my head, you know, and I just have to go from one thing to another. Like, I really believe I have a mild case of OCD. I like to really hyper focus right. on things. I tend to do that. And I want those things I focus on to be so right. They're perfect. And I'm uptight about it if it's not. And so it's kind of how I'm wired up. So just finding things that I can focus on and work on is what I do now. That's, you know, now that I'm retired, I just find things that I love and try to spend time in them.
Right. So is it the in the action of racing or lifting or whatever, working on your car or a bus or something, that gives you the relief mentally? Or is it, you know, maybe the weightlifting, or, you know, for me, riding a bike or and weightlifting afterwards, I get the relief.
Yeah, if it's whenever I do something that takes everything else out of my mind and it comes to one singular point, you know, because my mind races quite a bit. And so if I can find one focal point and everything else blur out in my mind, that's my happiest time. That's my best time. It's when I can be so hyper-focused on any one thing that everything else can wait for later. Because when I'm just sitting around, nothing can wait. We got to do it now. I got to do this now. Hey, get this done today, right now, you know. I can't stand away, but I'm fine with things standing waiting if I'm hyper-focused on completing one particular task.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's a good way to be as far as productivity goes, as opposed to,
you know, being scattered and starting 50 different things
like
and
that.
Not doing any of them well. Yeah.
Right. Right. Going back to one more crash, that when you're running the Aaron's car, the 55, and you hit the pit wall, did you realize how close that was to catastrophe while you were in it? Or did it take watching the replay?
As I was headed for it, I thought, oh, this could be bad. I mean, this could be it. This, because if I would have center punched the door bar with that wall, it would have been a sudden stop. I'm not saying it would have penetrated to hit me, but the sudden stop of that could have penetrated, but just the sudden stop would have been brutal physically. I had no idea how ugly it was until I saw a replay. And I'm really glad it went where it was, because it was a non-event, because it absorbed so much. But that could have been a bad one if it would have just been up in the door bars and not right behind the seat, right behind the back of the cage.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you've raced so many badass cars. And for me, I grew up racing go-karts and road course racing and stuff, and did the Canadian deal because it's half the season's road courses. So one of my favorite cars that you ran was the Cougar that you raced at Daytona. What was that like, and how did you get
roped
Jack
into
Roush
sports
was pretty
car racing?
Tight. Free driver.
Oh, okay.
You know, on you know, I was on his payroll. So he didn't have to pay me
right.
anything to come do it. But he also saw it as a chance to teach me and me to learn, and also some to promote me and his NASCAR efforts. So it was all those things. It was Jack. I didn't particularly love endurance racing and sharing the car with other people. It wasn't what I did, you know. But I'm real grateful for the experience I had, the learning that I did, and, you know, being able to be teammates with such great drivers. And, that was a hell of an experience.
Yeah, did you realize
Not
how big
really,
a deal it was to win that race?
But in 95, when Jack put the deal together with Paul Newman, and we co-drove with Paul in order to give him, you know, his win. I did understand it. And Tommy Kendall was an enormous, I mean, he had that thing on his back. And I, you know, he and I, you know, did all the night driving all the way through the night. And Paul did a fabulous job, and we got him a hell of a nice 70th birthday present.
Yeah, that's cool. He's a hero of mine for sure. You know, running his last Trans Am race at 82 years old, that's something to aspire to. Yeah. Now I've heard you say that you're a big race fan and you subscribe to all the racing channels and watch a bunch of racing. Do you ever watch the Canadian series running up?
I don't follow it as much as I do the late model dirt stuff. I have connections there,
right?
With Davenport's program, so okay. I you guys put on some hellacious races. I mean, it's crazy, but I can't say that I watch every one of them. Yeah, the competition is, I mean, sure, the racing's sure. Awesome.
Now,
God, that's what a great series.
No, it's great. And it's, yeah, with so many road courses, you know, a guy like Tagliani or Andrew Ranger is going to, you know, do well in the season. He's got a shot at it and stuff. And they, like you said, they are such good shows. And you see it now in Cup. They're adding a road course every year. What do you have any opinion on that? Any thoughts on that? That they keep going more and more street courses and road courses.
I'm all for road course racing. It's exciting, close contact, good stuff. I don't have a problem with it. I don't really have an opinion. You know, it's not my thing. I'm a fan. I watch it. I like watching it. But I like watching all the races. So I like road course racing. I don't think it should be the majority of our NASCAR schedule, but for a portion of it, I think it is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it certainly, well, I mean, you look at COTA this year and brings Kimi Raikkonen and Jenson Button and, you know, some outside eyeballs to the sport, which I think is great. And I guess looking at it, you know, now the world is so turned on to racing through that Drive to Survive deal. Everyone, you know, everyone's 17-year-old daughter watches every Formula One race now. What do you think NASCAR is going in the right direction from it being conceptualized by some people as a show to more of a sport? You know what I mean? Do you have an opinion on how that's going?
Talk about that. I just don't want to talk about it because, you know, I don't want to, everybody has their opinions and I get it that we don't live in the same world we lived in 30, 40 years ago. It's not for me to say. All I know is when I was young, I hated hearing all the old people talk about how terrible we were and how good it was back in the day. I'm not going to do that.
Right. I mean, you know, I'm such a fan of the green white checkered, and I hate to see, you know, being in NASCAR now, I hate to see sports car races and whatever end a race under yellow, you know. So I think that's that, in my mind, that's awesome what NASCAR did with that. You know, there's obviously pluses and minuses to that, but
you know, I think there's room for.
I mean, I think the racing in 2022 was the best that NASCAR had ever seen in history. So I'll say something positive.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that is the best racing on the racetrack it's ever been. So in 2022. So I'll just leave it right there. You know, do I love the cars? No, I don't.
Fair enough.
There's a lot of things I don't love, but I did love the competition. I did love the racing. So
some advice for young guys who want to make a living, even if it's just outside of racing, to follow their passion.
Well, following your passion is really important. Work ethic is really important. Being willing to work harder than anyone else. Being willing to do what the others won't do. That kind of stuff's what makes you great. And that's how you succeed. It's in my era, it was more work than it was brains. I mean, it's okay to be smart, but you just can't beat, you know, somebody that's outworking you. So that's the main thing. Follow your dreams, follow your passion. You only get one crack at life. Go for it.
Right. Well, I appreciate you taking the time, Mark. I guess the last thing is if you have any questions for Junior Hanley, he hasn't done a whole lot of visible stuff these days, but you know, a guy who was really in that golden era of racing with him. Do you have any questions or anything you'd want to hear?
He was always one step ahead of me. And so I would like to know what heaviest left side weight car he ever raced, and did it run as good? My heaviest one was 70%, and it didn't seem to race as good as my 64% car. So I'd be interested if his 75% car that he built, I'm sure, if he thought it was better than his 65% car.
Right. That's a good question. Yeah. I appreciate you taking the time, and everyone's going to love this one. All right. Take care. All right. See you guys next week.